Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, MacGuffinMan.com, to keep up on our previous podcasts. Our most recent was about uncut gems. I've also written a handful of things that I can put on the website if I stop being lazy. I also wrote a book that'll be available soon enough called Content About Content. I'll tweet a link to that. You can find it at the MacGuffin Man. Probably be out there in a couple weeks or so. But yeah, theme song. All right, Jim.
Yes.
Here we are.
Here we are talking about the best picture.
Yes.
Parasite. Continuing our trend of doing every best picture award winner, excluding Green Book.
Yeah, we skipped last year for reasons that we don't really need to dive into, but it should be obvious to any listener of this podcast.
Right. So we're going to talk about Parasite today. Mm-hmm. As we said, won Best Picture. Was kind of a big hit, made a lot of money. Obviously, a South Korean film by Bong Joon-ho, written by Bong Joon-ho and Han Jin-won. And this had the sort of a limited release in parts of Canada and in the United States. And I've just been listening to podcasts and reading interview around this time that it kind of first got released in that limited window there, and people really liking this movie and kind of crossing their fingers that it could win Best International Film or whatever the award's called now at the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
And it the idea of it winning Best Picture really seemed like a total long shot to a lot of people, but this is a director that's been on people's radars for a long time and has made movies that are critically successful, but movies like Okja and Snowpiercer, The Host, these are movies that actually made some money as well. So it's not just kind of a critical darling thing, which sometimes a foreign filmmaker is kind of what they can hope to do in North America. But this is sort of the kind of the new height of his pretty illustrious career, right?
Well, yes, most certainly. Winning Best Picture is definitely the new height of his career. But no, I said that in jest, but like you are right in that, again, just, to really simplify this, like my mom knows who Bong Joon-ho is now, you know, and, not, somebody who's pretty well versed in film, but certainly not well versed in, international cinema. And I'm not claiming to be either. I think, he's somebody who I've known about for, you know, probably a decade, I guess since The Host, but simply because I just watch plenty, and he's a filmmaker that filmmakers love. Tarantino specifically, I think, got some credit in one of his 4,000 acceptance speeches during the Oscars for helping to champion Bong's films in America. Not that I've seen everything that Tarantino has recommended, because that would be both an impossible task and just not fun. But he's right about Bong. Bong makes very fun movies, and he makes movies that are, they seem like they're pretty, I don't want to say that they like feel like North American movies, because that's just factually incorrect, but he seems very inspired by a lot of North American filmmakers. Like, particularly, I think you can see a lot of Scorsese in his work, and certainly Hitchcock. Like, there's a picture of Hitchcock in this movie, and I think the thing that I can really point to as Parasite's appeal is that, just the Hitchcock elements of it. I remember talking to a client of mine, like, in October. She had just seen Parasite, and she has pretty good taste in movies, but she, the way she talked about Parasite, she's a 60-year-old woman probably, and I was just started to clue into my head. I was like, oh, everybody's gonna like this movie. It's not just the movie, the film loving weirdos. Like, there's something accessible about it, and I think just the way that it is, I don't want to say it's a simple story, because I don't think it is, but I think it's not super complex, and it gives you a lot. It does give you a lot to grab onto at the beginning, and then just it kind of takes you through everything in just this It's this really incredible work of craft, you know? Like, it's just everything about it is just pristine. And it takes a relatively simple idea of sort of a con man story and adds class dynamics to it, of course. And then just, there's no wrong decision made through the rest of the movie, you know? It's just running through sequence after sequence, and it's just like, yeah, there's everything's done right, you know? He's a pro. Hot take. Bong Joon-ho knows how to direct.
No, and I think even in other movies, people talk about that he has a good grip on doing a genre movie. Mm-hmm. And then by the time that, I mean, I think just to focus on Parasite in particular, you kind of get a grip on this movie as kind of a lighter film. You know, by the time you're halfway through, you do get the sense of bigger ideas of class struggle. And, you know, there's definitely some heavier ideas going on, but with a couple moments of exception, it's kind of just a fun movie for the first little bit. You know, it's this little kind of cat and mouse game that they're playing as the Kims try to get into the Park family and inside of their home a bit more, and you know, just the different deceptions that they pull, and it's mostly played for laughs. And you like this family, you like the Kims. You kind of just want to see them succeed because they're your main characters and they're funny and kind of just fun to be around. And so,
and Song Kang-ho is like the most charismatic person alive as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so by the time this movie does take its turn, you really have a grip on all these characters, the Kims and the Parks, and you want to see them succeed. And then when things start getting heavy, as they do rather suddenly, it does kind of become a different movie, but you still bring over all your feelings and understanding of who these characters are, what their house is like, you know, the financial situations that both these families find themselves in at this particular moment. So it does kind of function in two halves, but they don't feel disparate, and they don't feel like, it doesn't feel like uneven tone. It just feels like an escalation, and because of the foundation that's been laid, it just makes the weight of the second half mean that much more to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to sort of combine our two points, I think the moment that again, not really breaking news here, but the moment where the movie turns is when you go into the basement and the housekeeper comes back into the house. And at that point, I think that's where you really see that dividing line, where it sort of changes into a different movie entirely, or at least sort of reframes everything that you've seen up to this point in the movie. But just the way that, you know, we've at this point been spending past the first 10 minutes, which are all in the Kim residence, we start getting introduced to the Park house, which is this big expansive space that we assume we've seen all of at this point, when the family is just hanging out in the living room all together as the Parks are on their camping trip. And the reveal of the basement, both how far they have to go to get into the basement, like once the secret door, and then walking all down all those steps, down all those corridors, and the fact that it's done in one broken shot, is really incredible. And it's just like, oh, you think we've been in this set this whole time, that it's just going to be a house? No, it's also a house with a dungeon, you know? And yeah, that's sort of the type of thing where I think some of the most important decisions in this movie, I mean, that's true of a lot of every movie, but specifically in this movie, because I think it's a movie built so heavily around production design, but some of the most important choices of this movie were made in pre-production. And I think the most important choice they made in this movie was building the house and building the house, like building their set so that it could be shot in the way that they've shot it. Because if you, just the simple fact of being able to see this big space and then being revealed, like going from that, wherever the plum extract is, that mini basement down to the real basement, that reveal there is just so important. It's the most important moment of the film. And it's when people are just start to reframe everything that they've seen to that point, and including the Kim family.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's obvious, but it's important to note that this is what's going on under them the whole time, right?
Yeah.
In a very literal sense, you know, they've had this life. You know, the Parks have had this life in this house. The Kims have had this life as they kind of, you know, work their way into this home. And everything that we've seen outside of that first 10 minutes, you says, is all taking place literally on top of this. Like, there is, you know, colloquial, this idea of things happening underneath, like there's something under the surface, and that is, you know, the literal reality of what's going on in this movie. And the notion of just height and elevation and ups and downs in this movie, I think, means a lot. Bong talked about this as his stairway movie, and we get a lot of shots of stairways, people even I just think of the first time that we see the Park House at all, when Wu Shik is going to do his first tutoring lesson there.
The first time. You said the actor's name. Ki Woo is the character's name, but yeah.
Yeah. He walks up these steps after, you know, the house from the road doesn't seem like much, and then he gets to that first gate, and then he walks up the stairs, and it's one of the first moments that, I don't know, for me at least, like, kind of the beauty of this movie really stands out. I mean, I think everything is well shot. As you said, it's the pre-production is important, and even there are some important, very telling shots of the Kim's home, but by the time we get to the Parks, and he's walking up those steps, and, you know, the camera spins around him, and there's beautiful plants nearby, and you see the house the first time, and it's very sunny. And just watching him travel up those steps, and the way the camera is shooting upward, kind of aspiring to kind of move up in a station of life, I think is one of the first times that you get this. But, you know, the fact that they live in the semi-basement, the fact that the Park's house is, you know, has multiple layers to it, you know, multiple floors, just that very notion of shooting up or shooting down, or the different, like the way that they use filmmaking language to show the hierarchy between these families and the Korean society at large, I think is something that you kind of can miss a lot of it the first time through, maybe, at least I did, but it is this visual element that gets played with throughout the film, and it's just a ton of fun to watch it track.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think levels are, like you mentioned, very important. And just the way that spaces are depicted are similarly important. Like, so what you're saying with Ki Woo, like seeing the new, the environment, the Park House for the first time, you know, up to that point, everything we've seen has been in the Kim house or in their neighborhood, where it's very crowded, it's very cramped, there's lots of people in a small space. When we get to the Park House, it's very few people in a very large space. And you look at even when he's just on the street, right, as he's walking in, it's just so empty, there's not a single other person there. And you see that again when a little bit later on, when he brings his sister Ki-young with him, the Jessica song that she does to remember her character, you see her do that song in a close-up with her brother. It's the two of them framed in a close-up. And then as soon as then she hits the button as soon as she finishes that song to say, "We're here." And then you cut to this incredible wide, like this huge wide shot where it's just the two of them in this huge space and there's nobody else there. And that pervades all throughout the movie, like all these other environments that you see the Kim family in. The cafe is packed, or sorry, the cafeteria, I suppose, and the internet cafe that Ki Woo and his sister go to. The gym that they go to later in the movie. Even like the Mercedes showroom is kind of like this middle ground where it's busy, but it's showroom busy. So there's not a lot of people. It's like, this is where people with money have to congregate to buy their car, but it's still pretty spacious, all things considered. It's probably incredibly busy and claustrophobic for them compared to other spaces we've seen the Kims in. It's nothing, you know? And I think that's something that runs throughout the whole movie and is really cool. And it never stops being like an interesting contrast, the way that they do it, you know?
Yeah, even so much as where the Park's home, or that entrance, is on the hill. Every time we see the Kims,
yeah, true,
next time they try, you know, whatever their latest scheme is to try to get into the home, we see them kind of walking up this hill, you know, trying to elevate their status. And then every time they leave, they have to walk down this hill. When the old housekeeper has to leave out in the rain, mm-hmm. you know, she's walking down the hill with all her luggage. When they eventually sneak out of the house after the camping trip goes poorly and the Kims have to leave, you know, they're walking down the hill, and then there's that much more wide shot of the city as they're walking, you know, further and further down, and you see this really, you get a sense of the kind of the larger geography of the city, but they're walking downhill. And just, I mean, this is a bit later in the movie, but just because we're on that subject now, the idea of what that night does to them, like mm-hmm. the fact that it rains, is sort of this minor inconvenience to the Park family. You know, the birthday party gets sort of, or not the birthday party, but their birthday camping trip gets canceled, and they have to come home and sleep in their, you know, extremely expensive house or the teepee in the backyard. And, you know, that's their night kind of ruined by their relative standards. But what it does to all those people who don't live high up in the hill, you know, we see these monsoon rains just devastating all this lower income people who live in the city, and it's mm-hmm. going into their half basements, and it's flooding everything and wreaking havoc on their plumbing. And then, you know, the next day the Park family talks about how, oh, it's clear now, and that the smell is gone, and there's no pollution today. And overall, it's kind of you know, whatever. It's a bit of a wash what happened with the rain. Our camping trip got ruined, but you know, now we have this nice day to have a party outside. Mm-hmm. Well, the Kim family and the rest of the people in that part of the city are still, you know, they've slept in the gym. They're extremely tired. They're still kind of putting their lives together from this thing that is devastating to them, but not to people who have more money, to the people who live kind of higher up on this hierarchy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that same moment, or that same portion of the movie that you're talking about, when the mom of the Park family calls Kyung the next day to invite her to the birthday party, you know, just the intercutting of their conversation, the mother's still getting ready in her bathroom, this big expansive bathroom, she's totally by herself, and you know, no lack of comforts whatsoever. And then cut to Kyung in this gym, just people everywhere, there's a literal argument happening behind her, like people yelling at the people on stage trying to figure out what's going on. And and yeah, just those two things cut together. And going back a little bit further to the storm the night before, the housekeeper who's dealing with a concussion at that point vomits in the basement toilet, and then you get the hard cut to the toilet and the Kim family just sort of like spewing out sewage. And it's something like that, where, you know, even the housekeeper in this house, just connecting those two things, like her refuse comes out in the Kim residence, and I mean, not the exact same vomit, but you know what I'm saying. And I think those the way that those two experiences, totally different experiences, are connected, especially in that night and then the following morning, is really impressive and important to where we get everybody before the birthday party. Or at the birthday party.
Yeah, and I think that the two, you know, matching shots you said of the old housekeeper and the daughter having to kind of, you know, deal with these toilets and different toilets in different ways, and it seems like that also touches on something that pops up again and again through this movie, which is that these two families are kind of at war with each other, the family of the old housekeeper and the Kims. And you know, it's for reasons that they, you know, there's just limited jobs. There's limited jobs for people with their level of education who still want to make a different living. And Bong has talked about, you know, the impetus of this was kind of starting with the tutor, because that's kind of one of the few ways that people in that social class end up dealing with people from the class above them, is by, you know, being hired to tutor them. And that's kind of one of the ways that families like that actually do intersect, and that oftentimes, you know, they're eating at different restaurants and going to different grocery stores and living in significantly different parts of the city. But this is a spot where it does intersect. And I mean, we've kind of only in passing touched on the class struggle of this movie, which is I'd say, you know, kind of the main theme of this, if you can
sort
of pick out one.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, it's kind of the crab in a bucket scenario, right? Like, these people are only getting by taking someone else's spot or standing on somebody else's shoulders and pushing them down. And that when there are, you know, limited jobs and limited resources, that it's kind of zero sum. We can't really all just elevate at the same time. It's all about bringing someone else down. And so that's what we see happening. It's not them kind of creating jobs. It's about creating ways to get other people out of their jobs. You know, we see the housekeeper gets, you know, they use their peach warfare and lies about her having tuberculosis. We see the driver being replaced for, you know, false sexual improprieties. It really is about them taking people down in order to fill that vacuum and to fill that space. And then and that was brought to mind when you're talking about those two matching scenes with the toilets, it's kind of this warfare that's taking place between them. And to have this image, you know, this the image of this toilet and those two kind of interacting with it in different ways at the same time is watching both of them kind of struggle to occupy the same place and be able to find their way economically by using the parks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I want to come back to this later because we've done our classic, we've jumped too far ahead right off the top. I totally agree with what you're saying. And I think the logical connection is to talk about that scene where the whole family's hanging out on the couch together when they're all in the house. But I think that sort of should come a little bit later. I think we should go back to the setup because I think we've skipped a lot of really interesting setup stuff. That's cool.
Sure.
With you. Just the way that the movie introduces us to this character and also ties into the things that you were saying about the levels, introduces us to the characters or the Kims, specifically. First shot of the movie is the socks drying on that rack above Kiwoo's head, who's about to find out that they don't have Wi-Fi anymore. And the camera tracks downward, you know, like we're moving down, to meet this family. And just the idea that, these signifiers of feet are above the heads of the people that we are going to be following with. I think that's sort of this really good illustration of class that really kicks off the movie. It's like these people are under the place, like what you walk on, you know, by way of, you know, by their class definition, right?
Yep.
Doesn't mean they're necessarily bad people. It's just like this is the place that they are. And that, you know, that could have been something that you'd come to just by seeing people walk by their place and seeing feet. But I think putting socks there is so really drives that point home, and that the socks are there towards the end or in the very last shot as well is notable. And just the way that we're introduced to this family, and I think the movie all throughout uses music really well. Like there's a lot of different instances of this piano music that comes into the beginning of the movie. It's sort of indicative of a person working alone. It's sort of this isolated person. And later in the movie, as the scheme starts to build, like when Kiwoo starts to like figures out a way to get his sister into the mix, you start to hear more instruments being added to this music as Ki-young's in the back of the car about to plant her trap on the driver, Yoon. You hear almost this military march, which ties into what Kiwoo said in his tutoring a little bit earlier. Like, you have to be marching through a forest with a machete. You have to march with vigor. And he's telling the daughter about how to take an exam. Just as the other family members continue to be added, we get sort of this build to almost more of a like a full orchestra, going from like a single instrument playing by itself to a full orchestra. And you can see it basically I have like 20 notes on it because I tracked it every time you hear score in this movie. But every time somebody is working by themselves, like towards the beginning and then at the end, you get the piano music. And even when the housekeeper leaves after being fired, you get that same piano music. She's on her own. And then as the family's working together, the music is just grander and just indicative of a team aspect. And I thought that was a really cool thing that was worth noting. But just to go back to the way that the family's established, like moving throughout their cramped, the Kim's family, Kim family residence is this sort of Steadicam shot that's really cramped, and like it never has a chance to be beautiful because there's just not the space to be beautiful, you know, and there's not enough space for people to move, which tends to be a big aspect of Steadicam shots being beautiful. And just the way we're introduced to characters, Katek is actually sleeping or pretending to sleep, depending on who you believe. And Kiwo is just trying to round up his family, and all the pizza box stuff is kind of what I really want to talk about, which is because the pizza box scene is incredible. Like, it's so funny and such an interesting way to start your movie, you know? I trust it made you laugh, pizza boxes.
Yeah, can I say one thing about the music?
Of course. Quickly, yeah, yeah.
We get to that. Yeah. No, I think the music's excellent. I didn't take maybe as many notes, so I won't be able to kind of reference it all specifically, but that scene, you know, when I think it's basically as they're trying to get the first house, the housekeeper fired there. As you said, you know, there's more instruments. It's more of them working as a team. And it's not just that there's a bunch of different instruments all playing at the same time, but we do have some of them. And then you kind of get one instrument taking the lead at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, you get this, it's not quite a call and response because they're not playing the same thing, but you know, it's very sort of conversational musically. We'll get a violin doing one thing and then that'll stop, and there's still other instruments playing in the background, but sort of that lead instrument kind of goes back and forth. And it's as they cut across these scenes, we cut across everybody doing their job, you know, coming up the stairs, getting the hot sauce, using the peaches, kind of all these different things, and all the Kims all do their specific roles, and it's matched really well orally with all the different instruments playing their little parts of the song. So just kind of another example to highlight what you're getting out of, you know, it is more instruments, but it's not just this cacophonous everyone playing at the same time. It's everyone doing their little part to create something different, and that's exactly the way that you know, all their schemes work out. One person will find out something, and then the other person will come up with this idea to do something, and then somebody will play something here and you know, plant the idea of something in their heads, and you know, tell the Parks what to say or what they found. And it's you know, just this, you know, literal orchestration of people doing things. And I can just picture that conductor like turning from one instrument to the other as they kind of have their lead part. And it's just those scenes are just so rewarding. You know, there's no dialogue. You understand exactly what's happening, and the way that the music just matches up with it. And again, it's shot at this beautiful house with the, you know, great actors. So all that together makes for these really compelling scenes, I find.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you adding more musical knowledge than I can muster for my points. But yeah, no, I can hear violin.
I said violin. That was my
You said an instrument. I just said music. So that's what you got one on me. But yeah, let's talk about the pizza scene, because I do think that the pizza box scene, because I think that I remember seeing this. I saw it twice in a theater, and you could really feel the people understand the tone during that scene, because it's in a way that I can't really explain in words, other than it seems like a very Bong scene. Like, it feels like a scene that only exists really in one of his movies. There's just something so unique about it. And I think that it's probably at the 5-minute mark of this movie, if that. I think it really sets the tone for what we're going to see with this family, because it's bizarre and it's funny and it's sad when they start like choking on the pesticide. And also I think it does a good job of setting up where they are, because I think the scene where if they talk about, I forget who mentions this, which one member of the family mentions it, but if we work faster, we can get paid sooner. It must be Katek, the father. As I'm saying it out loud, that sounds like such a Katek line. But and then he's the one who continues folding boxes as everybody else is choking on the pesticides. He's like, he's just got to get it done so they can get the money. And I think that sets a really important point for the movie that the movie continues to play with a little bit, like here and there. It's just the idea that having money kind of buys you the luxury of patience and quality. Like, they need this money, so they just need to get the boxes done faster so that they can get paid faster. so that they can not be stressed out for, you know, 5 minutes earlier, you know? And I think that sort of really sets, makes an important point about the difference between having money and not having money, is that I think a lot of times people don't understand that money can just buy you time and patience, you know? And I think that's something that, that this movie, it's nice to see that this movie approach, you know?
Yeah, and yeah, it's true. Like, I mean, Kitek not wanting to close the windows and just like that single-mindedness as his, you know, his basement apartment is being fumigated and he's just staring straight forward at this video, trying to fold as many of these as possible. He kind of turns off some very like human response mechanisms to being gassed in a small room, and just knows that he's doing this for his family and that they need money. And as you said, that he does not have the luxury of just, you know, we'll go outside and we'll wait for this to air out a bit and then we'll get back to folding boxes.
Well,
he focuses on it.
And the way that he moves is very robotic too, right? Like, he's not even looking at the box behind him as he gets a new one. He just literally reaches over the back of his head to, and immediately starts folding it, like almost before it's even in front of him. He's just already going, you know?
Yeah. And then Dong-ik, the father of the Park family, his, you know, the first time that he meets Kitek when he shows up to his office and goes for that first drive and says, oh, this isn't a test, I just want to get out of here. I mean, as an example of having money and not needing... not needing to work all the time. He just seemingly takes a half hour off and gets driven around for a little bit because, as you said, they have that money. So they have that ability to, you know, take the foot off the gas, to use an apt metaphor, and just sort of take some time that we don't really see the Kim family ever have the luxury of doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think something from that same scene that's worth pointing out is that I think that's the only time we see the father in a space with a lot of people, you know, like he's in a busy office. He's in his Another Brick office, which is an amazing name for their company. And it's just like, he can't be around people for too long. He has to go in a confined space with only one other person, you know, a small number of people. And I think that's a interesting contrast given what we've talked about earlier. But yeah, and going back to the pizza boxes, when they do get paid, the 25% of them are like one in four pizza boxes is a reject is really funny to me. The pizza woman, the woman who runs the pizza place, says to them, one out of four is a reject, as four people have been folding these pizza boxes. I just think that's a really funny line that also is so mean towards the family. I assume it's supposed to be directed towards Kitek, given the speed that he was working at and how speed focused he was. But I just thought that was really funny. Yeah.
And by the end of the movie, one out of the four Kims is dead.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
And at the very end of that pizza scene, you know, something I touched on earlier about only moving up in the world by, you know, knocking someone down. We end up seeing the family try to convince this pizza company to fire one of their employees in order for them to take their spot, right?
Well, they try. It's never really said whether or not it happens. You know, they're definitely trying to convince them just to let him go and bring in Kiwoo for an interview tomorrow. And yeah. The way that is shown visually is so interesting because it's all in one shot, right? And we've got the setup with the woman who runs the pizza place and sort of center frame, and we've got the van with the pizza boxes in the back with the other employee of the pizza shop, and we have Kiwoo, who's helping load boxes into this van. He comes up and talks to the owner of the pizza place, like walks up next to her, and we can still see the guy from the pizza place in the background, and he delivers a line. I forget what he says as they're talking about the guy who's not showing up for his shifts. And then at some point, Ki-young has moved into the left side of frame, so she's next to the pizza place owner. After that, pizza guy at the back delivers his line. She moves over to the other side of frame and blocks him out. You now can't see him because of where Ki-young's standing. And Chung-suk moves into the left side of the frame. And all throughout this, the camera is pushing so slightly forward. And it's like this family is descending on this woman and like preying on her. And it's my favorite shot in the movie because it's so, the blocking of it's amazing. And it just really introduces us to what the Kim family is going to do. They're just going to see, I guess, prey and just sort of like slowly hone in on it. And they're not physically attacking, but they're like scheming. And it's just,
yeah.
It's such a good shot and it's such a good scene. And I love it so much. Yeah.
Yeah, and blocking somebody out.
Oh, the block when she moves to the other side of the frame, it's the best. It's like that's like the real cherry on top, you know? Like all you can see is this woman surrounded by the family. There's not another human being in frame anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
So, what do we do now? Where do we go now?
Well, do you know? Do you have a take on why Mrs. Park is sleeping when he arrives for the first job interview for tutoring?
I think that's a comment on, I don't know. This is a life I've never experienced and a life I never will experience. But I feel like it's sort of a comment on the boredom of the stay-at-home mom. And which is to say, stay-at-home mom is a very difficult job. When somebody's doing a lot of the things that a stay-at-home mom would be doing, I assume there's a lot of time for daytime naps. You know what I mean? Like when they have that housekeeper there, there's probably like wine at 11 a.m. if she wants, you know, like, cause she just doesn't have, there's no reason for her to stay home because her kids are taken care of unless she wants to take care of the kids, which she kind of doesn't seem to want to, you know, like she doesn't hang out with her children. So it's, I think that's the comment is more that like, she's kind of unneeded. So she can sleep on the table in the middle of the day to a point where it's difficult to wake her up. Like she can be that asleep on a table, you know, like she's so, you know, she's sleepwalking through life basically, I think is sort of where we're, what we're supposed to think about her in that moment.
Yeah. And so are we meant to think that the Parks are bad people at all? Because they just seem to be, I mean, if we're going to like the protagonists, which would be the Kim family, then it seems like these people would be the antagonists, or at least the people that they're working against, at least for the first half of the movie. And I think you could make the idea that the sort of the class struggle element of it turns some of the less wealthy people against each other, which we've kind of talked about. So that's the conflict there.
Yeah.
But it seems that, you know, the Kims are deceptive and the Parks don't seem to be deceptive or criminal in any way that we see our main characters function throughout the film. So I just didn't know if what you think the nature of that conflict is and how negatively we're supposed to view the Park family or the Kim family.
So I would argue the real antagonist is society. But no, I think the everybody, there's no antagonist, no protagonist in this movie. We like the Kims, you know, like we're rooting for them because that's kind of just what the movie sets us up to do. But I don't think they're necessarily... I don't think they're necessarily heroes. I don't think they're necessarily villains. And I feel the same way about the Park family. I feel the same way about the housekeeper and her husband. I think it's just these are people who are dealt a specific set of circumstances and they are dealing with what they have. And naturally, my gut always leans towards not liking people who have a lot of money. Just in movies in general and I suppose in life in general, but I don't know. I think there's certainly an absence of knowledge for other people's experiences. And I think that there are a couple examples in this movie where it makes the Parks very unlikable, but the Kims are like, they're criminals. I'm not saying criminals can be unlikable. Every con person movie is built around the idea that a criminal can be likable, you know? And this is no different. So it's kind of, it's everybody's basic, like that's a long way of saying, I don't think there's an antagonist. I don't think there's a protagonist. I think there's a set of circumstances that are being approached differently by each family given their social status.
Yeah, okay.
So that's where I am with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that's, I mean, maybe not the right answer, but it does seem that way. I mean, it just seems like there'd be a million chances to make the parks look worse if that was your goal, you know?
Yeah.
It's the mother is shown as kind of simple, they say, to use dialogue from this movie, and there's really not much negative to say about the father, but I do think you're right that it's sort of these circumstances and how this hierarchy forces certain people to act certain ways. And yeah, I mean, the Kims are absolutely criminal in the sense that at the end of this movie they are charged with crimes that we've seen them commit, you know, and no one was framed.
Yeah, I want to make it clear that the MacGuffin Man does not side on the side of being pro murder, you know, like this.
Well, yeah, no, even without the murder, I just mean the things that the mother and son are charged with. Beyond that, yeah, it just seems, as I was saying, there's a chance to make the Kims look better and the Parks to look worse. I mean, we don't see the Kims do much to help out other people outside of their family, which would be a really easy way to kind of put a halo on them and look like the really good people in the society. And there's a way that the Parks could look a lot worse. And they really don't go there. So I do think it's more, you know, both of these families are kind of more emblematic of a spot in the class struggle than it is about being morally good or bad.
For sure. I think that the things that make the Parks unlikable are all ignorance based. It just that they have the money to avoid being able, having to think about certain things. And I find that every time they sort of come off as unlikable, it's just all ignorance based, you know, and ignorance of people below you. And this whole movie, as you pointed out, is the people below reacting to what the people above give them. And the Parks are the people at the top rung in this movie, at least of characters that we are introduced to. And so everybody has to react to the world that they give them, you know? So the kids are
Yeah,
reacting to that.
and to say one brief thing about the end, I think the worst time that we see the Parks look the worst, and it's really just the father, is when they're hiding behind, he and Ki-Taek are hiding behind the bushes for Dasong's little birthday cake, I don't know, play that they're about to put on with the axes and stuff. And you know, Ki-Taek, even watching it the second time, I really liked just how tired he looks. You know, he spent the night, first of all, like hiding under the table and then sneaking out, and then just how exhausted he is. And
Yeah, and
then,
his like face looks redder than normal. It's like it's really interesting. I don't even know how he could have done that. It seems like he like went for a sprint right before they shot these things, you know?
I know that's just the way he physically looks. It was really struck me just when I watched it the last time. But you know, and then Mr. Park just says, "Look, just consider this part of your work. I'm paying you more." And that, I mean, I think that's the part that is intended to rub you the wrong way, and is seems to be the thing that motivates Ki-Taek into doing that, and kind of the way that Mr. Park reacts to the smell of the housekeeper's husband. Those are the things that really kind of spurn Ki-Taek into the violence that takes place. And that seems to be the one time that the Parks just look the worst. He's saying, I'm paying you. It doesn't matter kind of how embarrassed you are or how you feel about this. Like, I'm kind of asserting my financial dominance over you when you don't really get to say anything at this point. So that, combined with the state that he's in physically and emotionally from being so overtired and be so spent, is kind of the time that it looks really bad on the Parks. And it's not like, you know, he's not being rude to him. He's not saying like, "Oh, I fucking own you. You have to do what I say." You know, he's just saying, "Oh, I'm paying you more. So therefore, like, just think of what you're doing as part of work, and therefore don't kind of question it or apply your own sensibilities to what you're doing. It's just like, I have more money." So that's kind of the end of this discussion.
Yeah,
And
exactly. Oh,
that
sorry.
seems to be the big thing.
Yeah, for sure. And the same is true to a lesser extent of Ki-young and Ki-woo. It's like, well, it's Sunday morning. I'm calling all three of you, and you're going to show up because I'm going to pay you, you know? And they all do, you know? And I think that's certainly to a less extreme extent than what Ki-taek is running through his head, and but I do think it's worth pointing out, you know.
Yeah,
absolutely. Everybody's at, every member of the Kim family is at that birthday party because they're being paid to be, you know.
Yeah.
So one thing that I feel like has been underaddressed, and I just want to ask you about this movie. So this whole movie, like, it really kicks off because Min, who is a friend of Kiwoo, asks Kiwoo to become the tutor of a girl that he wants to ask out but can't until she goes to college. That's okay. I just want to, like, clarify that, because nobody talks about that in this movie, and it just seems like a weird starting point, you know? I don't know. I just feel like that needs to be pointed out because it's weird and creepy.
Yeah, and I think that I was kind of reading more about things that someone like myself, who just isn't super versed in Korean culture, might miss out during this movie. And I think that the girl that Min wants to date is sort of depicted as childish in the way that she'll speak, and that there is this age gap that would exist between she and Min. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the person who ends up falling for her while supposed to be protecting her from the frat boys.
Yeah.
And so I do, my understanding is that there is sort of an uncomfortable age gap there. And that even though he's waiting for her to turn a certain age, that the physical stuff that does take place with her and the way she's talked about and the way that she seems to speak about, you know, their physical relationship in sort of a childish manner is something that is supposed to be unsettling about this movie. And now that's sort of secondhand information, so I can't say too much about it, but my understanding is that that doesn't look good on those two men, those two gentlemen.
Yes. Okay. Cool. I just wanted to, like, I don't know. I've read a lot of conversations about this movie and they never touch on that. It just seems like something that that people just skip over, and it felt important to bring up. You know?
Yeah, no, that's fair to address that.
Because nothing in this movie happens without the scene of Min explaining to Kiwoo the situation. So
yeah,
because I mean, Kiwoo gets in the door by way of connection, and then he continues to scam his whole family in. You know, so let's see. Let's see. Should we talk about the couch scene? Or actually, let's talk about Min for a second while we're there.
Sure.
Because he comes up a few times, and I think the family seems to like him. The mother is a little bit annoyed with him for bringing a Scholar's Rock instead of food, or says food would be nicer. But in the next scene, we see her cleaning the rock and talking to it. So she's not like against the idea of this gift, but seems to be well liked. And the person that Kiwoo's family don't necessarily want him to be, but like would like him to be like him, you know, and
full of vigor.
Yes, well, and just confident enough to
stand up to that drunk guy.
The guy pissing on the street, which Kiwoo eventually is later in the movie, after they have made the whole family's made their way into the park residence. They're now, or I guess it's probably before the mom has, but he now has the confidence, because he's now getting paid. He has the confidence to go tell that guy to fuck off. He has the confidence to be more like Min. And in the middle of the movie, I think this is near the basement reveal scene, one member of the Kims asks another, what would Min do in this situation? The response is, Min wouldn't be in this situation, which is for sure true. But and then even at the end, we get a prelude to more of a conversation we'll have later, but when Kiwoo's talking about buying that house at the end, he's dressed like Min, you know, and that's just his. That's what wealth looks like to him, is that gray suit, you know, and that style of haircut. And I think it's just sort of, it's always in Kiwoo's head that this is who I want to be, even if he doesn't vocalize it, or even if he doesn't necessarily know it himself. He's just like, this is what he's trying to be. He wants to be like his friend Min, you know?
Yeah, and he's very literally filling in for him, right? You know, he's taking his role in that family I mean, like, as an employee of that family. So yeah, it's quite clear that, you know, there might be an element of sort of fake it till you make it as he sort of starts to become Min, but it does feel, yeah, absolutely, by the haircut choice and some of the costume design stuff, that he really does inhabit that body and just wants to replace him and become him. And as you said, what would Min do? He, yeah, short of a WWMD bracelet, it does very much seem like that he is not just replacing him, but becoming him in order to get all the benefits that he sees, you know, the vigor, the confidence, the, you know, he gets the girl, he gets eventually into a, he thinks in a position in his life to become him. And, you know, we'll talk, as you said, more about that ending, but mm-hmm. of perhaps buying that house with his newfound identity.
Yeah, exactly. And and I think now we can jump to the couch scene, which is the scene that where the family's just all the Kims, sorry, are all hanging out in the park's living room as the rainstorm hits and the parks are off camping. I love that scene, one, because, I mean, we've mentioned how fantastic Song Kang-ho is. Every member of the Kim family is so good in this movie, yeah. In totally different ways. And just watching, it's one scene of the movie where we really get to see them be comfortable and just sort of having a conversation. Drinking together. I always love seeing families drink together in movies, because when there's no problems, really, like just comfort drinking, because you really don't yeah. see that a lot in movies. You see families drink to tolerate each other a lot in movies, but not like we're hanging out and drinking, and it's just not something that you see in movies.
Quickly on the subject of alcohol, mm-hmm. Have you noticed like the quality of alcohol that they drink throughout this movie always increases?
I guessed it. Yes, because there's certainly a brand, the first brand of alcohol that they drink, I did not recognize. You know, I assume it is a brand that is not available to me, like the first, the green yeah. cans of beer or whatever they're drinking.
Yeah, yeah, that's a pretty inexpensive Korean brand. And then they move up to Sapporo, as, you know, many people would recognize as their...
Yeah. The mom, more money. The mom in that scene, who is not in the park residence yet, is still drinking the green beer too.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And so they moved to Sapporo, and then obviously as they are having a discussion about, you know, being the parks and living here and living like this and how much the sister fits in there, which is something I definitely want to make sure we touch on too, because I think that there's a ton in there.
Oh, man, I've got so much on Ki-young. She's the best.
Okay. I mean, obviously that at that point, they're literally drinking their alcohol. So it's obviously high-end whiskey and things like that. But just that their ascension from cheap beer to good beer to fine liquor tracks the way that they at least perceive themselves, and certainly are making more money at a point. But at the end, I think we see that as kind of flying too close to the sun, reaching too far. I mean, it's we don't have to dwell on this as sort of a plot hole thing, but man, they party pretty hard about knocking over, like smashing plates on the ground.
I know.
Like, just leaving a mess all over the place.
Yeah. Well, talking about something that you never see in movies, when I'm talking about families just comfort drinking together, talking about something you see way too frequently in movies, people being blackout drunk and then immediately sober because the situation calls for them to be, you know?
Yeah.
That happens constantly, but, you know.
Yeah.
Movies are filled with high functioning alcoholics.
All right, so I derailed you to talk about alcohol, but where? So that that couch scene with the Park family coming home from camping.
I just think it's the scene of them talking is just really great, and I think you get a lot of moments of that's where they're comfortable enough and they feel safe enough to sort of actually just sit and talk and not really worry about what they have to do to keep their place, you know. And that's when you sort of get these considerations coming in where Kitek says about the mom of the Park family, she's rich but still nice. And then Chung-sook's comeback to that is she's nice because she's rich, which is this great line, and very I think really nice way of being considerate of their situation, you know? And it's like, if I had no money, I'd probably be a fucking nightmare as a human being, you know? Like, I'm grumpy. I'm comfortable in life and grumpy, you know? Like, just imagine if I was, like, stressed constantly, you know? And when they're talking about Yoon and they're sort of, like, talking themselves into the idea that Yoon probably found a job, despite the fact that he lost his job for reasons that are not his fault, you know, and they're just lying to themselves to make them feel better, you know, because I think the I forget if it's the mother or father earlier of the Park family mentions that they enjoyed having a younger driver because nobody has a younger driver. So he's probably screwed, you know, he probably doesn't have a job because it seems like the trend is to have an older established driver. And they're lying to themselves to make themselves feel better about what they've done, you know? And I think that's sort of where they're having this conversation at ground level. They're above ground. They're above where they're used to residing. And I think it's sort of where they're starting to elevate in their minds of their position, where they're still considering other people, but they're also trying to push past considering it because it just makes them feel sad, you know? And that's what Ki-young does when she says, we're the ones who need help, worry about us, you know? And she's the one that's the most adept to the sort of confidence man lifestyle that they've taken to living, and she's the one most adept at pretending to be somebody else. It feels like she falls into her character better than anybody else does. She doesn't need any direction from Ki-woo, that she's just like, she finds a way to go from, I guess, art teacher to art therapist very quickly, you know? And
yeah,
she can Photoshop a college degree that ends up being unnecessary because the mom doesn't care about documents. And she has pretended to be a member of wedding parties or something in the previous year. That's sort of a throwaway line at one point in this movie. She acted in weddings. She just seems really, and people are always talking about how comfortable she is doing this kind of thing. And it's like, she's sort of painted as a person who believes she should be here. And I think that lack of consideration for other people is a key aspect of somebody who should be there, you know, because we don't really see the Parks talking about, oh, I wonder how Yoon's doing, you know, I hope he's okay.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that this gets to the end a tiny bit, but I think that her death is a result of that, right? That's she's the only one that creates a job for herself instead of taking it. You know, there's the art teacher thing that she goes, she elevates to art therapist, which involves more money and more sessions per week.
Can I add a point on that before we talk about her death?
Yeah.
Real quick. So that sequence, that's another big, big moment of like, capital F filmmaking happening. And it's pretty noticeable. It's when, she has her quick meeting with the mom, and she goes up to, I forget the kid's name. Oh, Da-song. Yeah. To go have a lesson with him. And then she immediately like kicks the mom out of the room, which is a very Ki-young thing to do. You know, it's just sort of, she's asserting her dominance over the situation immediately. And, at the table, then they're talking about, when she's talking to the mom later, they're talking about, you know, her time with Da-song, and, she brings up, did something happen to him in first grade? And the mom gasps, right? And the camera swings around to the other side of the table. And we're now looking at close-ups from the opposite side. And it's like, now the tables have turned, you know? Ki-young is fully in control. And at that point, she says she needs 4 sessions a week. And she can now demand money at an art therapy rate because she's like, she has this woman fully in her grasp, you know, she can do whatever she wants. And later she says that when talking about how she did it, she said, I Googled art therapy and ad-libbed the rest, you know? And I think that's, I think the way that they show that, with the camera is a really cool way to show the, how the mom reacts to this. It's the,
yeah.
Cause that is like, swinging the camera across an axis is basically the gasp of filmmaking. You know, it's one of the more aggressive things you can do, and it's, yeah, it was cool. But
yeah, yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, so we get her. You know, her family talks about her saying, you know, she could be a con man confidence person if she wanted to. She's very good at lying her way out for the phone. She's the rudest person, which I think is meant to align her with the kind of the upper class, the way she smokes in the internet cafe and just absolutely shuts the person down for doing her job and telling her not to do that. It just gets an ashtray off of her and moves on. And as I said, she's the one who more or less kind of creates a job instead of taking one. So she's the one who gets out of this sort of lower class habit of knocking someone down in order to take their place. Like, she sort of embraces and puts forward this idea of class mobility, that you can start here and kind of work your way up. Even if it's dishonest, you can create a job, and that's how you're going to become part of this upper class. And that's kind of her sin. That's what she does wrong. She looks like she should fit in the tub there. She looks like she's part of the house. She looks like she fits in this kind of upper crust of society. And I think that's her undoing. I think that's what we're meant to take her particular death to mean, is that even the way she talks down to her own mother for bringing fruit in during the lesson, and, you know, Dasong sitting on her lap, she looks very comfortable. Like, she looks like she's immediately part of this family, and not just an employee of this family, but someone who talks to the help the way that they might talk to the help, who has this, you know, innocent but physical, very close relationship with Dasong. She does the most to embody this upper class. And I think that her belief that she can kind of move upward, you know, this movie is all about up and down, and the fact that she is confident and actually pretty capable of starting, you know, at the bottom of this and transcending and moving upward, or ascending and moving upward, that is, if this movie is saying that, if this movie is about class struggle and about how people are stuck in one spot or happy to be stuck at the top of it, that she meets her ultimate fate. She meets her awful, awful death by thinking that she's better than this caste system, and that she outdoes it.
Yeah, one of my notes was, what is the significance of her being the one who dies? So thank you for answering that. Because I did not have an answer, and that's a perfect answer. So let's talk about the birthday party, I guess.
Sure. Or did you want to talk about them stuck under the table a bit more?
No, not really. I think the goodness, like, that's one of those scenes where basically that whole portion of the movie, I honestly don't know that we can add anything. That it's just so well done, and it's so obviously well done, and it's so entertaining, and so obviously entertaining. Like, I don't know. I just think it's like just a great sequence. Just watch the sequence. Don't listen to us talk about it on that, you know? I don't think I can add anything to that sequence other than it's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm just tempted to point out some things that I bet other people, but when we have the Parks sitting on the couch, and we have the Kims literally lying down, you know, just another example being lower. And, you know, they're kind of lying there in complete silence. It's almost like they're in a coffin too. Like, their fate seems very sealed. It's all these things that would come with a good kind of sort of a thriller scene like that. You know, we have the parents watching the kids. We have, you know, the Parks on the couch watching the song outside, and the Kims are, you know, literally caught in the middle. There's this family existing. There's this domestic dynamic existing above and around them, and they're just stuck. There's nothing they can do. They're purely living on the Park's terms at this point, and they can't move, and they have to, you know, listen to this uncomfortable sexual interaction take place. And I say uncomfortable because you're there with your family listening to it. That's what makes it wildly uncomfortable. And just this notion of living on someone else's terms, living in someone's house and having to deal with their timing, their interpersonal dynamics, their sleep schedules, their sexual activity, purely on someone else's terms. And this movie is about them trying to infiltrate their house, the Kims infiltrating the Park house, and succeeding in a way, at least for a time, but the situations that they find themselves in when, you know, you're sort of waiting hand and foot on somebody else, or when you are forced into doing whatever you can to make a world within someone else's domestic situation.
Yeah, well, actually, you mentioned one thing I do that I think makes the Parks pretty unlikable, however briefly, is right before they mother and their father have their tender moment together, they're talking about how people on the subway have a certain kind of smell. They're actively sort of talking down about people who can't afford a driver, you know, which is regular people. And, you know,
and that sexually role playing someone using drugs is exactly part of it, like that power dynamic. Of
exactly.
Drugs.
They then fall into, that's what I was going to say. They fall into a role play of a person they fired and a drug addict, you know, and it's just like, that's gross. Oh, that's gross. You know, and like a class, the way that they're sort of like viewing the class below them as just a way to get them off themselves off. You know, I think that's, that is the time in this movie where they are like distinctly unlikable to me. You know?
That's true. That's one I was forgetting when we were talking about things that do make the Parks look bad.
Yeah, exactly. Live your best sex life, but don't talk shit about another other kinds of people to get yourselves off. You know?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Birthday party.
Oh yeah, sure. And I'll just say one more kind of thing. When they rush home and they want that Ramdon dish, and that sirloin beef is like an extremely expensive beef. It's Wanwu beef is my understanding of it, which is a kind of a Korean local or national delicacy, I guess. It's very, very expensive and very highly prized, and then it's being mixed in with ramen and udon, which is sort of seen as kind of comfort food, sort of cheaper food, and it's that to me is just this combination of the high class and the poor class, that dynamic that's being played out through a lot of this movie. And as we said, as they as that scene plays out and we see them unaware of each other, but or the Parks at least unaware of the Kims, that there is this dynamic of the both classes occupying the same space at the same time. But yeah, now we can talk about the birthday party.
Yeah, well, and also the that food is initially made for somebody who doesn't end up wanting it, you know. So
yeah,
I think it's good that somebody eats that. You know, looks quite delicious. So I'm glad.
It looks so good. I was so hungry the first time I watched this movie in theaters too.
I mean, it's 1:30 and I haven't eaten lunch, so I could go for some right now. But yeah, so I mean, the birthday party is again, it's like it's almost the culmination of everything that we've seen already, and I think the what you talked about with the father of the Park family saying you're being paid extra to do this, it really drives home the class dynamic and further pushes Katek towards what he's going to do. And I think the thing that really pushes him over the top, and again, the movie does a good job of illustrating this, is when Park gets the car keys from underneath the guy that's been living underneath the house, the way that he covers his nose is so like, it's like in that situation, there's just no way you would do that. Like, know. You know, it's so comical, but it's, and I think that brings us back to, it brings Katek back to the beginning when he's eating a piece of bread and there's a stink bug on his table. And that's the further layer of parasites that we haven't discussed, is the bugs trying to eat the food that belonged to the Kims. The Kims are trying to eat the food that belonged to the Parks. And then there's still these bugs underneath them. And I think in that moment, Katek sort of sees himself as the bug that's being flicked away by him at the beginning of the movie. And yeah. He's like, I'm not a stink bug. I'm a human being. And his reaction is murder. And yeah, just the sequence in general is just really well done. And that's when you get some, there's the cutaway of the blood on the food that I really love. This really quick shot when the housekeeper is probably right after he's slashed Chung-suk. It's a cutaway to like a piece of bread with blood on it. It's just, the sequence is done really well, you know? And I think you see all of those, everybody's coming together on the same level. Like everybody's on the ground level in that sequence, like all three of our families. And it's just the culmination of everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And then as we learn, Katek's escape, he gets out. I mean, we see this as the letters are sort of being written and read at the very end, but he gets out of the house and he's kind of, you know, considers running downhill where everyone else has escaped, and that kind of downhill walk that we've talked about as everyone leaves the house. You know, he's to put it lightly, definitely lost his place in this upper crust of society, even in the role that he had. And then he sees that he's going to have to kind of descend back to where he was before. And then he realizes that that's not an option, and that he has to go even lower than that. You know, he simply can't just go back to living in the poor part of the city. He has to find somewhere even lower than that. And the way that we've seen how, you know, that dungeon, as you said, that long one takes for it to go all the way down there, it's not even enough for him to be back to where he started because of what he's inflicted on the class above him, right? He has to go even further than that, and in solitude. He can't communicate with his family for a long time, as we know, or at least not in the way that that you normally would. He goes all the way down to this place that someone else was confined to, someone else whose life he understood as awful, and that we kind of, you know, we watched earlier in this movie him question, how could you live here? How could you live like this? How could you live in this basement with nobody? And it's a fate he's kind of sealed for himself by his actions during that birthday party, and that's where he ends up. And I don't know what your take on the very ending of this movie is, but maybe he'll be down there forever.
Yeah. Well, I suppose this leads itself to one last question that I had before we go back to the ending. Like, do you make anything of the difference in ages between the family? So the Parks are the youngest family. It seems like the Kims are younger than the people living in the basement. Do you make any sort of do you have any take on that? Because I don't have anything, and I was just curious if something I'm missing with the age.
Only insofar as that it seems like their fate is sort of sealed by this point. That the Parks are young, you know, the parents seem younger, the kids are younger, that they still have a lot of time and chance to do other things, and maybe, you know, maybe even make more of themselves, but at least they just have an option of doing what it seems they might want to do. Whereas the housekeeper and her husband who live downstairs, it just doesn't seem like things are going to be different for them, and that the only interaction, like the only changes we see in their lives, is she getting fired because of what the Kims have done, and then, you know, his brief escape and things like that. But it just seems like their destiny is already kind of finished. They've already sort of reached where they're going to be, and then we see the Kims try to make something of themselves, try to elevate, as we talked about, but there's just problems inherent in the system that they're never going to be able to get out of there. And they're going to see, you know, Mr. Park hold his nose because there is poor people nearby, and that they're never going to, even for all their confidence moves, except for maybe the sister, there's no chance for them to escape. And that's what I think most movies about class struggle are trying to get across, is that these are deep, more institutionalized, systematic problems that even bright, hardworking people, I mean, for them to take over all these jobs this quickly, they must be incredibly intelligent. And they're obviously, you know, you can discuss morally the value of some of their deceptions and things like that, but they're hardworking, bright, creative, clever people.
Yeah, especially with something like when you're a tutor, you know, there's like an objective. You know, the girl's either going to pass the test or she's going to fail the test. If her marks start getting worse, then you're going to get fired. So, like, in Kiwoo's case, he kind of has an objective. Like, he would just be... He's getting graded by her tests, you know? Like, if her tests start getting worse, then he's going to get fired.
Yeah, you know? And the mother becoming a housekeeper for a rich family. I mean, it seems like she must have had a huge part in raising her children, but... just the different foods and appliances and the way that, you know, that you or I could not function as a housekeeper for rich people, you know, even if we studied a whole lot and did nothing but focus on it. Like, we just didn't come from that. So there would be, I imagine, no chance of us passing off as that. But she seems to do it very convincingly, and everyone seems happy with her work. So it just seems like that no matter how kind of smart and talented these people are, that there's just no way to transcend when the class system is so ingrained in the society.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. Unless you're Ki-Woo and you come up with a plan. So the thing that the ending really reminds me of, Ki-Woo, the letter when he's reading the letter from his father that is transmitted to him through the light, through Morse code. It really reminded me of the ending of 25th Hour, you know, where they've got that yeah. dream sequence of Edward Norton not going to prison and instead making his own life at some other part of the country. Because I kind of feel like it's certainly not as long as that sequence, but it's the idea of somebody coming up with something like, yeah, I can do this. This is what I can do. And I will do this. And then we just come back to the reality of he's literally staring at the camera. And it's just like, no, that's not going to happen. You know, like, and it's just, I think it's such a sad ending. And I totally view it as a dream that will never happen. And it's sad. I don't know. Like, I know Katak's a murderer and all these things, but it's Song Kang Ho playing the murderer. So I'm always going to be on that guy's side, you know, like, it is still a sad movie because it's a family that has been broken up, and daughter has died, never going to see the father again. Son has significant brain damage. I don't know what the healthcare system is like in Korea, but a chance of incredible medical bills to deal with his brain surgery. And it's just all these things coming together. And it's just like we end up back where we were minus two people and some brain activity, you know, like it's
yeah,
it's sad. I don't know.
Yeah. And
like at least the sun is up in the first shot, and this one is just him sitting alone at night, and you know, so
yeah. And my understanding is that one of the, maybe not the first song, but one of the songs that plays over the credits is called 456 years or something, and
I think it's 546. I think you've mixed up the numbers, but
okay,
but close enough. at 100.
that's the amount of time that the length of time that he would have to work to be able to purchase this house and sort of free his father and live with them again. And so the movie is it does give us this scene of, look, it all worked out, I made enough money, here's at least a shot of us all together at once and hugging, and it's sunny out and the house is still beautiful and we're all together. But it's not naive. It's that scene is knowing that this is the dream that he will look forward to, and there is essentially no chance of him ever attaining it. And just going back to that notion that, you know, you can look upward and you can dream of a kind of a future reality, but when things are so inherently structured in this way that it's impossible for upward mobility, that's all it's going to be. It's this kind of silent, distant dream that, you know, it's off in the distance and it's hazy and it's unrealistic and ultimately unobtainable.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the last thing that we haven't talked about is the Scholar's Rock that Min brings. And I think it ties in a little bit here, where it's kind of like, I did some research on the Scholar's Rock idea, because I was like, I got to know what this is. There must be something. No, it's just a rock. It's a rock that people collect, and it has like certain, these things tend to have like, it's just a cool looking rock, you know? And Ki-Woo tends to, seems to gravitate to it. At one point he says it's following him, like when he's lying in the gym holding it. He takes it out of the sewage water, but it also sort of like levitates in his hand. Like, it doesn't seem like it's taking a lot of strength for him, like, to lift a rock out of water. I don't know. It sort of seems like he's doing it a little bit, but it's also floating itself. It's an interesting shot. And at the beginning of his little voiceover, where he's talking about his plan, writing his letter to his father, he puts it back in the water. He puts it in a river with a bunch of other rocks. And I think the idea of that there is he's going to stop sort of, it's not like not, it's not really a, like a prayer thing, but it's sort of the idea of the rock when Min gives it to them, as he says, is, will bring material wealth to families. And what he's doing, I think, by putting it back in the river, unless, again, there's something I'm not understanding here, he's putting it back in the river, or he's putting it in a river somewhere. We don't really see where he's putting it. It's just a close-up. It's like he's just leaving it behind. He's going to start working for these things himself. And that's the beginning of his dream. And it sort of ties back into the same point you were saying, like, you might as well be hoping for a rock to bring you out of this, because working hard isn't going to do it either. Kiwu is in the class that he is, and 546 years from now, he's still going to not have that house, you know?
Yeah, and it's the rock comes when on the same, you know, Min's same visit, where the idea of him replacing him as the tutor is introduced, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the beginning of everything for them, trying to move up and make more money. And then it's eventually what he wants to use to kill the housekeeper's husband, and it ends up being the thing that gives him, you know, this brain damage, right?
Yeah.
And I think he thinks that the rock is going to bring him material wealth and money, and it briefly brings a bit of both, I imagine, but is this is extremely harsh reality that it ends up causing him this brain damage that makes him smile and makes him laugh, but obviously makes him unhealthy and with a, you know, a less accurate understanding of the world and how to react to it. And so it is something that it shows up with this idea of aspiration, but then it gets put back, and it gets, we end up seeing that it didn't bring about the things that he wanted to bring to him in a very traumatic way.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, do you have anything else you feel is pressing to mention?
No, go listen to our Memories of Murder podcast.
That does not exist. Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Check back next week when we'll be doing another movie. All right.